In his architecture, Antoni Gaudí was obsessed with two things, natural forms and light. A utopian socialist in his youth, he fell in love with Pepeta Moreu, but that love was unrequited and he never married. Gaudí became more and more strictly Catholic as he got older, adopting a life of severe austerity. And yet in his work, he came up with all that wildly flamboyant modernist architecture that's now world famous and a major tourist attraction in Barcelona, where he lived. Producer Mike Ladd has put together a personal meditation on the contrasts between Gaudí's life and art. This is Gaudí and the Light.
The light is dry in Park Güell. The stone walls wear capes of bougainvillea. The hills are planted with pines, loquats, carobs and olives, with an understory of prickly pear and oleander. Pigeons, sparrows and a species of light green parrot busy the air. Barcelona below stretches luxuriously to the sea. On this estate, Antoni Gaudí lived for most of the last 20 years of his life in a demonstration house for a failed real estate project. The house wasn't designed by him, though the park's entrance pavilion, terrace, viaduct, stairways and fountains were. Only two houses were built, one of which Gaudí bought himself on the advice of his patron, Eusebi Güell, who lived nearby in the existing mansion of the estate. The pious, celibate Gaudí moved into the house in 1906 with his niece and elderly father. What catches my attention in Gaudí's house, which is now a museum, is his toilet seat. The usual oval shape is interrupted by two concave half circles at the front. I wonder if he wanted a shape that fitted the back of his legs better, or simply preferred a more complex curve, inspired by something he saw in nature. His furniture and architectural forms resemble bones, corals, seeds, fruits, and the insides of seashells. They're made up of curves derived from straight lines. The straight line is the expression of the infinite, he said, thinking how a little mathematics applied to straight lines could produce the same shapes as sunflowers, grass tips, and the buds of plants that grew on his building sites. He noted parabolas in the buttressed roots of figs and capons and designed them into his columns and walls. He utilised spirals, honeycombs, the planoid surface of magnolia leaves. The forearm crosses on top of his cathedral are drawn from the pine cones of cypresses, and the light wells resemble the shape of protozoa. He said, "The great book, always open, and which we should make an effort to read, is that of nature. The catenary curve, which is produced by the force of gravity on a straight line suspended in two places, such as in a chain fence or a spider's web, he thought of as the embodiment of perfection, and considered it his religious duty to use in his designs."
Direcció, casa.
There had always been an aestheticism within him. His reverence of nature combined with an early drive towards utopian socialism, ongoing vegetarianism, and a sometimes dangerous tendency to fast. Though a famous architect, he embraced a Franciscan concept of holy poverty. His neglect of such worldly details as the condition of his clothes may even have brought about his death. On his daily walk to confession, he was hit by a tram. By this time, 1926, he was in the habit of wearing threadbare suits, and he didn't carry identity papers. The tram driver described Gaudi as a homeless drunk who was not looking where he was going. Shamefully, he was left unconscious in the street. What does that say about the times, and would it really be so different today? At last, a policeman took him in a taxi to the Paupers Hospital, Santa Creu, but it was too late to save him, and he died there 3 days later. In the hospital, his underpants were found to be held together with safety pins. Gaudi's style teeters on the edge of kitsch, but nonetheless represents a unique vision that a whole city has finally embraced and turned into a huge source of income. More tourists visit the Sagrada Familia than either the Alhambra or the Prado. The souvenir shops of Barcelona are full of his imagery. It wasn't always so. For decades after his death, his work was looked down upon, seen as vaguely embarrassing. Casa Mila, one of his most important buildings, was nicknamed La Pedrera, the quarry, because the locals thought it looked like an ugly pile of rocks. Almost all his commissions came from private patrons or his connections within Catholic organisations. The city of Barcelona itself only ever gave him one job, the design of some lampposts. He was often in conflict with the city authorities over his flamboyant breaches of their building codes. This exotic, fruity modernism, now world famous, flowered inside the mind of an increasingly doctrinaire Catholic who said his prayers twice a day on his kneeling chair, facing the wall and the crucifix at the end of his single bed. His monkish embrace of poverty was driven by his belief that sacrifice was the true act of love. And yet his buildings are so extravagant. There was a fascinating mix of rigidity and fluidity in his character, the straight line and the curve. His true obsession was not line, but light. He said, "Glory is light. The light of joy is the soul's pleasure." And for him, architecture was the transportation and ordering of the light. In his cathedral, Gaudi wanted the congregation to feel like it was sitting in a forest of giant trees, with light pouring through the branches to an understory of flowers. The morning I visit the Sagrada, storm clouds are approaching Barcelona. I have a back view of the town from my terrace, This is a place of chimney pots and TV aerials behind the facades of Gracia. The aerials look like complicated fishing gear, or against the storm clouds, like intricate oriental writing, very ancient, never yet deciphered. Here is where odd things are stored, small lemon trees grown on rusty balconies. It's a place of pipes and wires and strung things, where the air conditioners breathe out. Suddenly the sun cuts under the clouds. One of them resembles, for a moment, Joan Miró's painting, The White Glove, a hand floating in the sky. And I think of the freedom of that work, and how all our best art is free. As complex as that, as simple as that. Swallows spiral before the rain front. When I enter Gaudí's cathedral, I'm surprised by how much it affects me. There are tears in my eyes as I walk, chin up, head pressed back into shoulder blades, through the glory. Glory seems the right word here, of the light and space. Is it a deep memory of a religion I grew up in, but have long dismissed as a dangerous cult with a bad record of child abuse? Behind all this effort, the intense labour of building a cathedral that began 100 years ago and will take another 25 years to finish, even with modern technology, is a glaring question. Does religion, any religion, do more harm in the world than good? Later, on my way back home from the cathedral, I'm inexplicably drawn to open the door of a small church. Inside, I see empty pews in front of a black iron grill. Behind the grill glitters the golden scrollery of religion. In these places, I always feel the iron, not the gold. But then, in the empty church, I hear female voices muttering, chanting low. Are the carved saints talking to me? Is this a conversion moment? It's not until I come right up to the grill that I see them, prostrate, totally covered in white sheets like ghosts. The nuns don't know I'm here and continue their recitations, and I stand there listening to them. Then I turn and leave silently, embarrassed both by my temporary alarm and my intrusion. Those living women in their white shrouds. Something about it horrifies me. I wonder if Gaudí's celibacy also had a religious basis. His niece, Rosa Ageia, said that her uncle simply had no interest in women. In his youth, he was handsome, but clumsily shy, and inclined to lose his temper quickly. A romantic myth has grown up around his one failed proposal of marriage, as though the pain of this rejection was behind all his subsequent art. There's no question that the refusal hurt him deeply when he was in his 20s. But the idea that it drove his whole life as a businessman and architect is nonsense. The woman in question was Pepeta Moreau. Gaudí met her in 1884 at the Mataro Cooperative Textile Mill, an early and successful example of a worker-owned factory. She was teaching French and piano there and running the kindergarten, and he was building workers' housing. He was 22. They shared socialist ideals. Pepeta had already been married, and I wonder if there was something of a Mary Magdalene attraction to her for Gaudí. Pepeta's first husband was Joan Palau, a soldier and trader in North Africa. He was a drinker and a gambler, and violent to her, finally leaving her in Iran when she was pregnant with their child. She played piano in a cafe to make a living. There were rumours of prostitution. But Pepeta's biographer, Anna Maria Ferrin, says this is merely slander against an adventurous, young, free-thinking woman who happened to find herself in difficult circumstances. With her parents' help, she returned home to Mataro, where her daughter was born, but the child died at the age of 3 from diphtheria. Gaudi often visited Pepeta in her parents' house and waited until her formal divorce from Juan Palau before proposing to her. She refused him. Though they shared political viewpoints, she was repulsed by his social clumsiness and his tendency to leave food caught in his beard. Besides, another man had beaten him to it. She had already agreed to marry the builder, Josep Caballol. Gaudi was devastated and embittered. Josep and Pepeta had 4 children and a happy life together. When Caballol died, Pepeta married the wealthy businessman Josep Vidal, and she opened her own fancy hat shop in Barcelona, becoming a successful fashion designer. For a time, Gaudi lived in the same street as her, Disputatio, and watched her come and go. Pepeta outlived him, dying in 1938 from Parkinson's disease. By 1912, Gaudi was living alone in the Park Güell house. There's still a sense of lonely austerity here. His 93-year-old father had died not long after moving in, and his niece died at the age of 36. He'd been her guardian since the death of his sister, also called Rosa, in 1879. Gaudi was the only one of his siblings to outlive his parents, and his niece was the only offspring. A huge shadow of mortality loomed over him. Increasingly, he looked for consolation in his religion, dedicating himself entirely to its rituals and the building of the Sagrada. In the last months of his life, he moved into his workshop in the basement of the cathedral itself. Of course, he didn't know they were his last months, and though he was an old man, he was still hoping to live long enough to see much more of the Sagrada Familia completed. His workshop was a gloomy space of plans, models and sculptures in progress. In the shadows was an agonising crucifixion figure, the body a taut bow, as the nails tore through the hands. On the walls were photographs of the mosaics of Ravenna. The workshop smelt of eucalyptus. Gaudi kept a pot of eucalyptus tea boiling on top of the stove to keep away mosquitoes and alleviate his rheumatism in the damp basement. And then there was his bed, pushed right into the darkest corner, as though he was already laid in the crypt. His eternally single bed, a check blanket, a view of nothing. His workshop was burnt by the anarchists during the Spanish Civil War. All his plans and drawings and models went up in smoke. If he'd lived into these times, I wonder if it would have challenged his faith to see how the Catholic Church formed an unholy trinity with the royal family and the fascists during the conflict. Somehow, I doubt it.
Thank you.
This morning I woke up and the sun filled the eastern window, and the swallows were there as always. I sliced a white nectarine and ate it slowly for breakfast, each wedge sweet as the summer light. I watched the steam from the red amber of my cup of tea drift back in the breeze from the window. It's Sunday, and I think of that poem by Wallace Stevens. Complacencies of the peignoir, and late coffee and oranges in a sunny chair, and the green freedom of a cockatoo upon a rug, mingle to dissipate the holy hush of ancient sacrifice. It raises the same questions for me as Gaudi's cathedral. The colours and sunny light, such opposites to the dark sacrificial religion, the weird bloodiness of its torture cross, and tombs and coldly distant God. In the Stevens poem, the woman, enjoying her secular Sunday morning, says, "But in contentment, I still feel the need for some imperishable bliss." Ah, yes, the temporal thing, I might answer, putting down my cup if I was sitting there with her. The feeling that all this is not adding up. Just a parade of pleasant or unpleasant sensation. At best a Matisse, at worst an Otto Dix. This swallows flight of a life. But the poem concludes that all we have is nature and our imagination, which is part of nature, though it dreams things that are not, and both are perishable. The final lines go to the pigeons who fly downward to darkness on extended wings. Here, this morning, there are no pigeons, but the swallows, as ever, lift into the light.
On RN, you've been listening to Gaudi and the Light, written and narrated by Mike Ladd. The sound engineer was Tom Henry. Thanks to Ruby Ladd and Nakane Reitamarua for Spanish translations. Visit the website where you'll find a photo essay on Gaudi and a link to a time-lapse animation that shows the completed Sagrada Familia, which the current builders are trying to finish in time for the centenary of Gaudi's death in 2026. There's also a push in some religious circles to make Gaudi a saint, but that's going to depend on a miracle or two. So if you've recovered from a terrible disease as the result of having prayed to Gaudi, please contact the program.